misapprehensions and so forth. And a little study about the deal does give you some ideas perhaps that you never thought of before. I know that I learned a few things here that I hadn't thought of before. And the word wine, oinai or oinion, means the grape tree or the vine plant. And since grapes don't grow on trees, vine plant would be actual, more like it. The root word, however, this is the Greek that I gave you, the root word is probably from the Hebrew yain, which was not confined to an intoxicant. Some say it was, but it was not. But more frequently, it referred to a thick, non-intoxicating syrup that they made. They used as jam. They produced it by boiling water and then storing it exactly the way we do in cans or jars, or in this case, they more often stored it in skins back then. But they boil it down, and it became thick. And as you all know, if you take jam, you can set it outside your refrigerator and just let it sit. And it takes a long, long time before any mold grows on it. Sooner or later it does, I suppose. But then what do? You just take that little bit off or pour wax, put wax over it or whatever. But anyway, by boiling it down, thus killing all of the yeast germs or fungus germs, yeast is a fungus that would be there, why, they could keep it. And that was no problem. And how people today and in the middle centuries got the idea you just couldn't do that. No way to preserve it. Certainly not true. And if they had done just a little bit of a studying of the ancient literatures and so forth, they would have found some. So, that's what they did. You wanted some grape jelly for breakfast? You took some of this boiled down wine that was boiled down to a thick syrup or sometimes even a little more, and you spread it on. And it was not fermented whatsoever. So, and this is backed up by people of old, Aristotle and Pliny and so forth, said that the water, they used the term, the water was added to this syrup to make a beverage. How many times have you read when you studied about this issue, or you just read it in, say, the fathers, the ancient church fathers, they water with wine, water with wine. No, they added water with wine. Well, why? I mean, who wants their wine diluted down? Now, first of all, of course, that word wine, again, Greek or yain in Hebrew, does not necessarily mean it's fermented. It doesn't mean that. It can mean it, but it doesn't have to. And in probably more cases than not, it doesn't mean it. So, you boil it down. You don't want to drink a bunch of jam. So what do? You add water. So that's why they speak so much about wine mingled with water. That they just added water, reconstituted it the way you used to do Borden's, you know, sweetened condensed milk, or the stuff you got out of the can, which was one half the volume, and took that milk and added 50% more water, and you had regular milk. Well, this is the way it was with wine. And that's why you find that terminology used so much. How many of you, if you were drinking people, which we're not, but would want to take fermented wine and add water to it, dilute it down? Who want to take their beer and put 50% water in it and dilute it down? Well, no, they wouldn't think of that. And so why were they doing that to their wine? Simply because it was boiled down so it would not ferment. And then they had to add water in order to make the regular drinkable wine. Very simple. So I don't know how people have been off on it so long. Now this oinos was wine or drink. And again, when I say wine, I'm saying it in the English, but I'm using it in the form of the Greek or the Hebrew that allowed either interpretation. So when I say wine, I'm not saying intoxicated unless I specifically say so. So, this oinos or wine was drink made from any fruit or grain, dates, apples, pears, barley, lotus seed, etc. And if they were talking in this word wine or oinos specifically about grape wine, then they use the word oinos ampelinos. So if they just said wine, that didn't necessarily even mean it was from the grape. Grape juice was also prepared. Now this is the case where they wanted to keep it more like juice rather than a thick jam or syrup. They prepared it by heating it and adding resinous gums or sulfate of lime, which is gypsum. They added that to this juice to ferment, to prevent fermentation. Of course, they always boiled it first to get rid of the extra yeast fungus that forms the fermented, and you all know the fact that it's a yeast fungus that gets into the grape juice or other fruit juices that causes the fermentation. So we have fungus among us when we and it's interesting the fact that fungus must exist absolutely everywhere in almost every particle of the air, because I've never heard of anybody sitting there a jar of, say, cider and putting it out there where it will ferment and it not fermenting in the hard cider, because there just wasn't any yeast fungus there. Have you ever heard of that? No. So that means it's everywhere. So that's where you can have, why you can have fermentation anywhere you are, because there's some of that stuff in there. Now, how did this idea of wine in the Bible and so forth become such that everybody used to think that, you know, wine, that's always referring to the fermented? Well, that comes from the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, when drinking was a big thing. And, of course, the Catholic Church had introduced the fact that the Lord's Supper wine was fermented and so forth. And so every time they read those passages in the Bible about wine, they thought it was the fermented. So really, it's our own fault, our own European ancestors' fault, that gave us the wrong ideas. And it was did not come from the Romans or the Greeks or anything like that. And of course, back in those days, just like is true today, it was a big thing to drink. You know, that was a great thing to have these parties and drink and get a little drunk or a big drunk or whatever. And so they preferred, when they saw that word in the Bible, wine, to think it's fermented. And there was no indication of that whatsoever. So, if they wanted to be still in the form of juice, then they just add this sulfate of gypsum and resinous gums, and they still practice that in every grape-producing country of Southern Europe and Asia. So that is still followed today. And again, people are still saying out there, they just couldn't keep it from fermenting. Oh, yes, they could. They could back then. They do it right to this day. So let's look at a few scriptures now. Let's look at Matthew 9:17. Matthew 9:17. This is a scripture that has confused many, caused a lot of wrong ideas. Nor do men put new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the wineskins burst, and the wine pours out, and the wineskins are ruined. But they put new wine into fresh wineskins, and both are preserved. Now the idea that you used to hear is the fact if they put new wine in old wineskins, you know, the old wineskins had already been stretched, you know, and so if you put new wine in those, they couldn't take fermentation, because fermentation puts off a little bit of carbon dioxide and so forth, and it would blow these up. Well, you know, when you study it out, that's one of the craziest arguments you can come up with. You put yeast in bread. It's a similar yeast, and it produces carbon dioxide from the carbohydrates in the bread, and that yeast takes that and turns it into carbon dioxide and other things, and the bread rises. Now, I asked my wife, how much does bread rise if you, say, put it in the bottom of a pan with about this much of your dough in it? How much does it rise? Well, it keeps on getting higher and higher. And then you put it in the oven and it gets higher yet. And yet, a lot of that's escaping. But the part that remains in there is enough to blow up that yeast or that bread, that dough, from down here to maybe 3-4 times, would you say? Well, imagine if you took the part that escapes too, you'd have 10, 15, 20 times as much carbon dioxide formed. And so, if you put unfermented wine in, I don't care whether it was an old wineskin or a new wineskin, it wouldn't make a speck of difference. Because unless you put that much wine in the bottom of each one, and that's all the wine you'd have, why, it's still blowing up. Because there's so much carbon dioxide come off that, boom. I mean, they sealed it, all that carbon dioxide trapped in there, it doesn't make any difference. I haven't studied it out, but I know from enough about distilling and how much carbon dioxide and alcohol even is produced that it would blow that skin to smithereens, even a new skin. That's obvious. So how could people say, well, the new skin will stretch enough, when it's stretched maybe 10%, I don't know. That would not accommodate the carbon dioxide produced in any way. And if it was wine, you have carbon dioxide and you have alcohol even, and some of that evaporates. And it's in there too. It's going to blow up. Do you know the difference between water vapor and water? If you take water, a gallon of water, and you completely turn it into water vapor, which is a gas, 1 gallon of water would form 1,700 gallons of water vapor. That's the principle of the steam engine, you know. Take the water out of the heat and it expands, pushes the pistons up, and you have your engine. Well, look at that liquid alcohol. It becomes vapor. That's, in fact, that's the process of distilling. It forms alcohol, and it goes through all these tubes, I guess, to cool off, and it comes out a liquid. But just imagine all that alcohol going through those distilleries in vapor form, and then coming out in alcohol. The alcohol is, say, 1/15th as much as all that vapor that comes out. So the point is this. Carbon dioxide is a vapor. Alcohol is a vapor. And there's no way, I mean, some of it becomes vapor. And there's no way that they can come up with the idea that just using a new wineskin that can stretch is going to take care of the problem. No. Maybe if you put 5 ounces of it or 2 ounces in the bottom and that all fermented, even then it'd probably blow up the thing. But who would use that kind of a thing? I mean, why use it at all if you only put in your jar, your wineskin a little bit in the bottom? So that's ridiculous. Okay. And that's, of course, one of the big reasons they used. They couldn't store it unless they used these new wineskins, and even then there's a problem. Now, I'm just seeing whatever other ideas I have here. Now, the question comes here. Since they couldn't even put it in new wineskins and they not burst, why would it be that Jesus says they put it in new wineskins and it doesn't burst? And why? Well, because they specially prepared the stuff that they were going to put in the skins. They did not just pour grape juice into these skins. They specially prepared it through this boiling process. Sometimes it was boiled down to 1/3 of its volume, where it became this thick syrup or jelly, or sometimes it became so hard as it stayed in this in these new wineskins that they had to dig it out with a spoon. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about that was put in the new wineskins. Now, since it didn't ferment, why couldn't they put it in the old wineskins? Well, there's two possibilities here. Probably the one is the truth, but there was in old wineskins a whole lot of leftover bacterial, or not bacterial, but fungus yeast that could cause a little bit of fermentation at, say, the bottom, wherever that touched. And even that would be enough to blow up the old wineskin a little bit. But I don't know that that's the case. I think it's the other case that people have suggested, men of old have suggested, and that is the old wineskins were brittle. So even though the dry, brittle, they hadn't had anything in them for a while. So even though you put the specially prepared jelly in there, and that specially prepared would not expand, why, still the brittleness, you'd lose many of them through because they're old and brittle. But that is a question you do have to answer, and that is, okay, if you put the jelly in there and it's not going to ferment anyway, why couldn't you put it in the old wineskins? And it could be one of those two answers there. But it could not be the fact that you have normal amounts of fermentation, or you're talking about so much extra gas in there that would blow the whole thing up. Okay. Now, let's go and look at Luke 7:33. Our time here. Luke 7:33. In fact, maybe I better just tell it. Here's where the Pharisees and lawyers rejected Jesus' baptism, or John's baptism. And because of that, why, Jesus talked about them, and he said, used the illustration of kids playing in the market, and they played a funeral dirge, and the other kids wouldn't join in on that. And then they played a happy song, and kids wouldn't join in on that. And the point is, you couldn't satisfy them either way. Whatever you did, you couldn't satisfy them. And so Jesus says regarding the Pharisees that you couldn't satisfy them. John the Baptist came, not eating and drinking, and they said he has a demon. And Jesus came, eating and drinking, and they said, behold, a man that's a winebibber, and so on. And so, was Jesus a winebibber, a user of fermented wine? No. Because remember, the charge they brought against John the Baptist was wrong. He didn't have a devil in him. And the charge they brought against Jesus was wrong too. He was not a wine bibber, a habitual user of wine, didn't use it at all, in fact. But they called him that. So don't use that, or don't let anybody use that as a reasoning, because the argument's false. John's argument was definitely false, he didn't have a demon, you can safely say that Jesus's what they said about Jesus was false too. Furthermore, to add this point right here, going to add it later, but I'll add it now, and that is, Jesus was a high priest. In fact, you didn't even have to be a high priest. And what did the law say in Leviticus regarding priests? Well, I don't have time to read that, but it said, Moses told Aaron, you and your sons, which didn't just include the high priest, when you enter into the sanctuary to go about your duties, you do not have any wine or strong drink, lest you die. So, Old Testament priests were not allowed to have fermented wine or any other kind of berry juice that's fermented, or they would die. So all are we not in the New Testament, all priests in the sanctuary, all the time serving God? So there you have it. Aristotle said this. This is just more emphasis of what I already said, basically, that by keeping for a time in skins or jars, this became as thick as butter and had to be cut out by spoons. In fact, I already mentioned that. And so were they just putting regular old juicy wine in there? No, they were preparing it first. Pliny, he's the one that said they reduce it down to 1/3 its bulk, and when they do this, it secures a finer flavor. That is the best wine. That's what they called the best wine. Now, most of the time when they reduced it down to 1/3 its bulk, boiled out 2/3 of the water, they added spices and other things, even other kinds of berry juice in different combinations. And that was called sapa, which means well-flavored and savory, delicious. And what's it say regarding Jesus at the wedding feast? Well, it says that the host said, hey, normally the best wine is saved for last. Well, for the people of the middle centuries, and even today, they say the best wine is the best wine because it's fermented more or whatever, you know, ages and all that. And then they try to bring back and say that's what it means. It has to mean that when Jesus introduced the Lord's Supper. It's more fermented or better stuff that Jesus produced, because after all, the people were well drunk, and so then they couldn't hardly taste the stuff. And so you usually serve the best stuff first when they can still taste it. It's good. You know, that's the idea. And that's ridiculous. They had what they called the best wine, and it was merely made by boiling it down to 1/3, adding spices, adding certain combinations of other berry juice, and it was called sapa, which means, in the language, well-flavored and savory. So that was a better wine than just the stuff straight off the vine, even. So that's the best wine spoken of there. And I'm going to go quick here because the time ran out here quickly. If I can have maybe 5 more minutes, because I... Okay. Okay, got to pick and choose what I want to go over here. Okay, Timothy. Well, boy, that is really a misused one. 1 Timothy 5:23, you know. No longer use water, but use a little bit of wine, basically. Again, we don't have time to read it. First of all, my first thought came completely on my own, and probably you've thought of it too. Since when does alcohol help the stomach? Have you ever heard? I've never heard anybody ever tell me that alcohol helped the stomach. Well, then what sense did he make? How can all these millions of people say that's what Paul was telling Timothy to do? That maybe they didn't have enough good water. If that was the case, why, just think, everybody from the time he was little on up would have to be kind of in a perpetual state of semi-drunkenness for their whole life because there's not enough water. See? Well, that's ridiculous. But that's what it means if people say, well, there wasn't good water, so they had to do this. People come up with all sorts of stuff without even thinking about it. And so alcohol does not help. If it was grape juice, now that has been known to help. And here's what a little study shows. Stomach wine, they had a thing called stomach wine, or wine for the stomach, that our old ancient writers tell us about. And what was it? Well, it was grape juice, again, prepared as a thick syrup for use as a medicine, for a dyspeptic, for a weak person that had stomach problems and so forth, weak person in that way. It helped, this stomach wine. But it was just this regular old wine that was boiled down and then reconstituted, and that's what helped. So, and a few more things quickly. What about in the communion? Did Jesus use fermented wine in the communion? The obvious answer is no, because it's called the fruit of the vine, which never referred to fermented wine. And furthermore, if he did, what would happen? We have a person in our congregation that's a recovered alcoholic. And if she were to drink this wine fermented, what happens to those people? Well, they go back to it. They can't even have a little bit without going back to it. So that we would be making a drunkard out of her. And who knows how many other people we might be that didn't have an alcoholic problem at first. So that's ridiculous. God wouldn't do that. And then, of course, the absolute argument for that is simply this. There's a whole bunch of reasons that I have down here, but we don't have time to go over. But if you look at your scriptures, there's 15 or 20 scriptural principles that Jesus would have violated if he had turned that water into wine and given it to people who were already well stuffed with it, drunken, not drunk in the regular way, but just stuffed. And they had drunk a lot of it, and he produces 120 to 180 more gallons of the stuff. And he gives it to them, and so he's setting wine before his neighbor. Sin. He's causing the drunk to get drunker. And then he's condemning them for drunkenness, saying, by that such people shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. How many of you have three or four scriptures on that? Sin number two. Sin number three, what do people do when they get drunk at a party? What do they do? Well, the men get loose and they go pick somebody else's wife, and they might go outside with her. All those things we don't have time to talk about, but we all pretty well know, experienced or not. Inexperienced, you hear it, and experienced, you really know what went on in your Christianity before you became a Christian. And Jesus would be responsible for all those things that they did. And so, with that in mind, why we're about here at the last thing, I had to kind of go all through my notes here because of the speed, and I'm seeing if I figured out or missed anything that's might be useful. They even had names for this jelly or jam or syrup. The fresh grape juice when they produced this jam was called mustum. And mustum, it wasn't the regular old fermented stuff. And I think I've covered here enough to get through a few points. If you want some scriptures, Jesus would have violated James 1:13 that says, God tempteth no man. He tempted them. They were already well drunken with their inhibitions slowing way down, and he puts more in front of them. Then you'd have to say, God does tempt man. But he didn't. And he condemns drinking. Philippians 5:19 to 21, he says, the fruits of the flesh, people that partake in those shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. 1 Corinthians 5:11, 6:10. Paul says that it is good not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything by causing your brother to stumble. And what did Jesus think of stumbling blocks? You put a millstone about their neck and they are cast into the sea. And so Jesus would be a stumbling block. And then you have all the scriptures that are in Proverbs, which this week is about Proverbs. They're not going to talk about Proverbs and drink, I don't think, but there's a whole lot of them in there that Jesus would be violating. So, I mean, we have a clear-cut case against wine. God did allow in the Old Testament the Jews to use wine. But he also allowed in the Old Testament the Jews to just get rid of their wives. What? God said, I hate divorce. And yet Moses said, you find something unseemly, you can divorce her. Because of the hardness of their hearts. So why did God allow that for his Jews, which are his believing people supposedly, to drink this fermented wine? Well, the hardness of heart. But we're in the Christian age. So, thank you.